Good morning and happy new year, everyone. I hope all of you had a fantastic and lovely holiday season. Although it is now ending the end of January, it's currently Tuesday, January 24th, and you are listening to CITR 101.9's weekly news radio show, Against the Current. CITR 101.9 is a campus and community radio station based on UBC's Point Grey campus, are located on the unceded ancestral and traditional territories of the Musqueam people. Every Tuesday at noon, we bring you timely and relevant news coverage of the Lower Mainland, which we then rebroadcast every Saturday at the same time. My name is Jasmine. I'm the news collective lead this year, and I'll be hosting today's episode, but for each of our segments today, I will be handing it over to Theo and Bridget, other members of our news collective team. For this week's episode, we covered the opening reception for Chinatown Looks, an intergenerational disposer camera project, which occurred last week. And we also chatted with Spencer and Jessica, the co-directors of the Student Press Freedom Act, about the campaign and what their goals are for this act. I will now hand the reins over to Theo, who covered the Chinatown Lux reception last week.
On a rainy evening last Tuesday in Chinatown, the Massey Arts Society hosted the opening reception of Chinatown Lux. In the intimate gallery, residents, artists, and visitors gathered to celebrate the photography of 21 Chinese senior and youth members of the Yarrow Intergenerational Society for Justice. The Chinatown Lux project gave the artists photography lessons and an opportunity to create and share cross-generational knowledge by documenting the neighborhood with disposable cameras. I spoke to the event's organizer, Rachel Lau.
Hi, my name is Rachel Lau. I'm the programs manager at Yarrow Intergenerational Society for Justice, and I was previously a CITR member.
Fantastic. So can you just tell me a bit about like how this event came to be, what went into the process of creating it?
Right, so we actually had a community zine launch at Massey Arts back in 2022, and I really liked the space and I wanted to have something that was a little bit longer term. And so then began the process of thinking about what would be the next arts project that Yarrow would hold. And actually I was inspired by Megaphone's Hope and Shadows calendar project, where they distribute disposable cameras to their vendors and they have a photo contest each year and then they create a calendar with the winning photos. So I was very into this idea of using a very accessible medium like disposable cameras, something so simple, and just handing back the power of being able to look back to the people of the neighborhood. So because I think that Chinatown is often a neighborhood that's looked at in a voyeuristic way. And so I think it's very important for the members of this community to be able to show what their neighborhood looks like through their eyes. And so then I contacted my friend Solomon Chinakwe, and I asked him if he wanted to participate in the project, because he is usually someone who likes to teach photography in the community. So he was kind of a perfect fit. He's also based in Strathcona, so it was kind of like a neighborly project, if you will. And then I decided that it would be really lovely to have an exhibition to bring Chinese seniors and youth into art spaces, just because Chinatown is being heavily gentrified at the moment and art spaces are often at the forefront of that. So I think it's very meaningful to bring the community that's being affected by gentrification into these art spaces to reclaim them and to be able to show their perspective.
At the event, a panel of three of the artists, Rosie Wang, Amy Nofek Yang, and Betty Ling, shared their work and experiences taking photos. The discussion was in three languages, Cantonese, Mandarin, and English. Betty, one of the senior artists, brought the house down as she described her architecture-focused photography and the struggle of getting good shots in public.
For Betty, her photo was a photo of the front of the Freemasons here in Vancouver. So the Freemasons actually held Sun Yat-sen when he came to Vancouver, and the local embassy was trying to exile him and send him back to China, or the Qing Dynasty back then. So the Freemasons actually supported him, helped funded him, and even helped funded the revolution in China. When taking the photo, there was actually a lot of people around, many cars, and took a long time to take a clean photo without people or cars. And a lot of the folks' cars were top-down cars, and it was like men with their girlfriends, and whenever I took a photo, the girlfriend would turn away, and I thought to myself, I didn't even want to take a photo of you.
Rosie, another senior artist, took a landscape photo of the ocean that depicts the boats that line the coast of Chinatown on a daily basis. She described her appreciation for the project as a learning experience. This is her translation.
Hey everyone. So my picture is the third one that you can see. It's an ocean whale. And I really like, I want to say first, I really like this kind of event, and I really like to take photos since I was a kid. So I really enjoy this process of taking photos of this historical street and buildings and landscapes, and I can really see Chinatown these times through this photography project. And I think it's really meaningful for our seniors to have this kind of, you know, like intergenerational event. So it's playful, but also educational, you know. So I learned that how to, you know, like take better photos from young people, and I really enjoyed this event.
After the panel discussion, I spoke to some of the youth artists and volunteers at Yarrow. Ada Yim is a Vancouver-based photographer and filmmaker. Their photo on display was a barbecue duck in the window of a shop, taken from a low perspective that accentuates the warm red hue of the food, which reminds them of home.
Well, my name's Ada, and I've been living in Vancouver for 4 years. I do photography. I'm also in film school. Yeah, I volunteer with Yarrow. I helped out the seniors. We took the tour around Chinatown to take photos, and I also had the opportunity to grab a disposable camera myself, so yeah.
Had you ever worked with disposable cameras before?
I played with them. I wouldn't say I worked with them or had any work be shown on it in the gallery. But it was fun. It was very different. It's very different, especially in the digital world right now.
Can you just speak to me about like your relationship with Chinatown and what you tried to feature in the photos you took?
Yeah, so the photo I took is in the barbecue house, what we see in roasted ducks. To me, it's probably the most exotic part of Chinatown. When folks do visit Chinatown, you see these roasted ducks hanging in, like behind the window. It's also something that's very memorable. As a first generation immigrant from Hong Kong, Chinatown has always been the home away from home. And I wanted to feature a glimpse of Chinatown that even as locals, you'll see like the daily lives basically. And barbecue pork is part of our the daily cuisine. Yeah.
Was there anything that you learned while doing the project that you are going to take with you, either into your work or just into your life?
Yes, I think right now there's a lot of work in the greater community to reconnect with our ancestral roots and, you know, our heritage, where we came from. And for me, it's a very important story, having been through, you know, assimilation and also learning a very different narrative, a very biased narrative in terms of colonialism. And now going really round circle here, going back to like my relationship with my heritage and how that has changed over the years. Is kind of, yeah, was what inspired me to be part of this project.
I also spoke with Amy Nofek Yang, who was on the panel but agreed to speak with me after the talk a bit more about her experience with Chinatown Looks.
Hi, I'm Amy. I'm a volunteer with Yarrow Intergenerational Society of Justice, and I've been a volunteer for the past 2 years. So this project was actually a collaboration with one of the artists from Chinatown, Solomon. And what we did was, it was an intergenerational collaboration. So they paired a bunch of Yarrow volunteer youth with seniors, and we were actually able to go walk around with our senior after our little photography lesson, and where we were taught how to have photo compositions and take nice photos. And then after our walk, I came back a few times and I took some photos. And the one that's on display right now actually is a poster that was made by a lady who was on Hastings. And it says "Changes for the Better, Downtown East Side." And I had asked her for consent if I could take a photo of it. And she said, yep, for sure. She made it herself. And she said, this is the motto I live by. This is what, this is my daily motto. This is something that I'm hoping will come to fruition.
What were you looking for when you were going around the neighborhood and looking for photos?
I was honestly looking for anything that would catch my eye. But I also wanted to really encapsulate the daily life of Chinatown. So I really tried to take photos that were very simple, very down to earth, stuff that you would see if you were a regular who lived in Chinatown on your day-to-day walks and just walking around the community.
And you mentioned that you don't live in Chinatown. I'm wondering what your relationship with the neighborhood is, and how that relationship tied into the work you were doing.
For sure. My mom is actually Taiwanese, so I am a half Asian. And growing up, it's always been a bit of a struggle trying to find out, you know, which community I belong to or where I don't, because I always fit in, but also at the same time, not really. And so I feel like being a part of Chinatown has really allowed me to feel closer to my roots, and it allows me to actually be around people who do share the same culture as me. And it's nice in the fact that they can share with me and I don't feel like I'm doing it for like as a show, I guess. And it's just really truly allowed me to bond more and learn more from the seniors that come before, and hopefully me being a part of Yarrow and helping to work in Chinatown will help me improve Chinatown for the people who come after.
And one of the main themes of this project was intergenerational learning and teaching, and I'm wondering what were some of the key things that you learned in doing this project from the older generations?
So on my walk with my senior, because he does live in Chinatown, he's lived here for many, many years. He was able to kind of walk around, tell me the history of buildings that were there, buildings that used to be there, stories about what Chinatown used to look like when he had first gotten here, how it's changed. And, you know, it's something that I don't get to experience, considering I'm coming in as to where Chinatown's at now and I don't know the history. So it was really nice and eye-opening to really understand and get a greater depth of what Chinatown used to be and, you know, what the lives of people were like before then.
In an effort to connect youth and seniors in Chinatown, Yarrow has been putting on community-based projects in the neighborhood since 2018. Rachel Lau explained a bit more about the organization and their work.
Yarrow Intergenerational Society for Justice has been around in the neighborhood for some time, but we were officially a nonprofit society in 2018, and we primarily focus on community building by way of service provision as well as intergenerational relationship building. And we're all about creating connections between seniors and youth in the Chinatown and Downtown Eastside area by taking care of each other and building relationships that are strong and that are able to traverse language barriers and generational gaps, as well as socioeconomic and social challenges.
Edward Chung, the event photographer at the reception and Yarrow volunteer, expressed his appreciation for the organization.
They're the most consistent and genuine. I feel like it's just genuine commitment and effort and care with the things they do. So the youth, I'm really volunteering for the seniors. They're kind of like, they're engaging with them as equals or friends. They're building more than just like, you know, like they're not just racking up volunteer hours. They're really engaging with these seniors, and they'll be working towards something bigger to achieve stuff together. And that's what I like about them. So And the fact that like everyone here radiates that energy is like what I really connect with, and that's why I keep coming back to this organization.
Rachel reflected on how the Chinatown Looks project allowed for the photographers to connect with the neighborhood and reconcile with the changes it's undergoing.
I think that ultimately photography is for everyone, and I think it shows in the sense that there are very human moments of interest as well as human moments of emotion that are shown through the photos, whether they be joy, connectivity, resistance. And I think that's true for most photos that you see, not just this exhibition. But I think that really shows in the photos that came out in this exhibition. And also people's different relationship to Chinatown, the sort of old Chinatown and also the changing Chinatown. And I think that in these photos you really see perhaps a sense of nostalgia for what Chinatown was or what people remember it to be, as well as their reconciliation with what Chinatown is becoming or what it is now. And I think those themes are being grappled with by the photographers in those photos. And honestly, it's just nice for people to be able to photograph their lives and document it, because I think that while it doesn't seem like something that's a very big deal now to document everyday life, I think that as Chinatown changes, it will prove to be very important, especially as our elders pass on and we want to maintain their knowledge and their contributions.
The Chinatown Looks Gallery will be on display until March 16th at Massey Arts Society. If you would like to go, the address is 23 East Pender Street in Chinatown. It's open to the public from Monday to Sunday, 12 to 5 p.m. There will also be a photo book launch and closing reception on March 10th. If you'd like to learn more about the Yarrow Intergenerational Society for Justice, you can visit their website, yarrowsociety.ca. That's spelled Y-A-R-R-O-W Society. To learn more about the Chinatown Looks Project or Massey Arts Society, you can visit masseyarts.com. That's spelled M-A-S-S-Y-Arts.com.
Do you want to change the state of the world, but instead you keep buying material goods to satisfy whatever desire you have in that very moment? Me too. But now you can do both! Rock Shop and Community Thrift is a local vintage shop that fulfills your 1970s alt-chic fantasy while also supporting at-risk people through their compassionate and supportive work training program. All of their profits go to the PHS Community Services Society to support ongoing healthcare, harm reduction, and health promotion projects in Vancouver and Victoria. So stop by their two locations, Community Unisex on West Hastings or Community Frock Shop on Corral Street. And if you know any other local businesses that deserve recognition for their generous business practices or their contributions to the community, please DM us on Instagram at CITR and Discorder, because we would love to spotlight them. Because hey, if you can't stop buying, you might as well start supporting.
We all know that the word jazz means many different things to many different people, so check out the real deal on The Jazz Show at CITR 101.9 FM or CITR.ca for live streaming. Yours truly, Gavin Walker, is your host, and I guarantee the straight goods of 3 hours of jazz at its finest. The jazz feature that focuses on a concept, an album, or an individual artist will be heard at the beginning of the show every Monday night, right at 9 p.m., after our opening theme and announcement. So come on by and give your ears a musical workout, 9 p.m. Mondays. Don't miss it.
Thank you. Slice of Life Art and Gift Shop is Vancouver's choicest destination for one-of-a-kind artist-made prints, posters, screen prints, riso prints, paintings, acrylic paintings, watercolor paintings, ceramic mugs, ceramic plates, ceramic bowls, ceramic pots, lapel pins, hats, toques, crochet bathing suits, jewelry, trinkets, knickknacks, hand-painted signs, curated thrift, and a bunch more stuff that won't fit in this designated block of airtime. Slice of Life Art and Gift Shop, located at 1636 Venables, just off Commercial, open 11 to 6, 6 days a week.
We don't need to tell you that Vancouver has a housing problem.
Mass evictions.
Mass rent evictions.
Unfair rent increases.
What happened to rent control and protection from unfair eviction?
If these or other housing matters concern you, you may be interested in joining the Vancouver Tenants Union. For more information, visit tenantsunion.ca.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiam, Nisiaya, Thinkum Queen Ansep, Hydra CM, Nisiam, Nisiaya,
and the Skakuya, Talitin, who must we must deal. The Student Press Freedom Act is Canada's first student journalism protection legislation. The student's freedom of expression and of the press is protected by the Charter, but it's unclear to what extent. The SPFA aims to clarify this and protect student journalists from censorship and undue interference from school officials. I'm Bridget Stringer-Holden, and today we have SPFA co-campaign directors here with us. Spencer, a UBC political science and information science student, and Jessica, who's studying political science and business at the University of Western Ontario. They were nominated for the 2022 Peter Bryce Prize for Whistleblowing and selected by the Book and Periodical Council as Canada's Champions of Free Expression for 2023.
Yeah, so welcome. Thanks so much for joining us today. Maybe we could just start with some introductions. Maybe Spencer, then Jessica.
Sounds good. So my name's Spencer. I'm a first-year student at the University of British Columbia studying political science and information science, and I'm the co-campaign director of the Student Press Freedom Act.
My name is Jessica Kim. I'm currently studying political science and business at the University of Western Ontario here in London, and I'm also the co-campaign director for the Student Press Freedom Act.
Perfect, thanks. And then what made you interested in journalism and what led you to wanting to start this campaign?
Yeah, for sure. So I guess the answer for how we got into journalism in the first place is just really a love for learning for both of us, particularly in that like current events and kind of social studies, as you would call it, in high school realm. And also a curiosity. So that was kind of what brought us into journalism in the first place. We were lucky enough that our high school already had a student paper, so we were able to join that and continue with it into leadership roles throughout high school. But in terms of the campaign, I'll pass that one off to Spencer, and he can talk a little bit about that.
Sure. So the reason we started the campaign in the first place is because we had so many issues with our high school, disallowing us to print journalism that was in the public interest, that we decided something needed to be done about it at the provincial level. And we needed to secure our right to freedom of expression and freedom of the press by way of enacting a law that was custom designed to make sure that what happened to us in the series of intimidation, harassment, and denial of rights to freedom of expression did not happen again to student journalists who were trying to conduct themselves in favor of their communities. And that's kind of why we started the campaign in the first place.
Perfect, thanks. Yeah, and what do you think the previous charter did for students? Where do you think it was lacking? Like, what gaps needed to be filled?
So the way the charter works is it applies to all government actors right now, which is perfectly permissible, and student journalists do in public schools do enjoy Section 2B rights under Section 2B of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. The issue is we don't know how far those rights to freedom of expression actually go and extend and work in a school environment. Unlike the United States, which has heard from the Supreme Court specifically on how constitutional rights related to free speech work and the First Amendment works in the confines of a school. We don't have that jurisprudence from any Canadian courts at that level in British Columbia or nationally from the Supreme Court of Canada. So really what this does is we introduce statutory protection for freedom of expression, which is something traditionally that is protected by the Constitution. We're going beyond that and making sure that in addition to the Constitution, we have this law specific to British Columbia, and hopefully we can see this spread across Canada, that really defines student journalists' rights in the context of a school without having to cross their fingers and hope the court gets it right if the court ever hears it.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, and could you just share what you're trying to achieve with the Student Press Freedom Act? Like, how will you know your goal's been reached?
Yeah, I think that's something we've kind of found difficult throughout the campaign is there really is no good record keeping of student journalists being censored just because of the nature of the power dynamic. And oftentimes it doesn't make any like media. So, I mean, we're a rare case in this instance. So it's hard to measure it in that measure the impact of the SPFA in that like using those metrics. But I would say one thing that we're really hoping to do is make this a wider known issue so that people are aware that student journalists are being censored and then prevent it, obviously, with the passage of the SPFA.
Yeah, of course. And could you just sort of provide a brief rundown of the campaign, maybe share any misconceptions you've had, things like that?
Right. So the law we've drafted up right now, us and a host of other civil liberties organizations that have been very generous in helping us out with that. There's about four main things it does. The first, and we talked about it before, it introduces a general right to freedom of expression for student and freedom of the press for student journalists. The second thing it does is it ensures that they don't face any retribution for acting in accordance with their rights under that statute. The same goes for teachers and administrators for allowing students to do so. The third thing it does is provide their student journalist sources protection. So anonymous sources used by student journalists cannot be disclosed or compelled for disclosure by a school official unless there's a really pressing and substantial reason. And the last thing it does is it allows for a forum for access to justice. So if there's disagreement between the administrator and a student journalist or a student newspaper of what content goes in the newspaper, an administrator believes that the content infringes, they are allowed to censor according to the act, and the student journalists disagree. You can appeal that to a special committee within the school district, and if you don't like that, it goes to the board level, and if you don't like that, then you can file for judicial review, which is a pretty common practice in things like this. But those are the four main things it does.
Perfect. And then what about any misconceptions that you've had, frequently asked questions?
Well, one of the questions that we often get, besides you asked one of them, which is why do we need this in addition to the charter? Another one is, why do we need the law? And why do we have, there's exemptions within the law that don't quite match the contours of speech outside of school. And the question that really is ancillary to that is, do students have the same rights to freedom of expression within school as they do outside of school? And our answer is, two part. I mean, one, we don't know, and no one really knows, and that's part of the reason why it takes so long to bring something like this forward, as it is the first of its kind in Canada, and we don't have any rulings from the courts really telling us what those limits are and if they are different. So we're really working off of what we can understand from the United States and what we can understand from other elements of historical education law in Canada. But we do reassure people that this law is not exactly an absolute right to free speech, and there is absolutely content and expression that can be limited justifiably, we think, and that's built into our law.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I see you've spoken at the British Columbia Civil Liberties Association, the British Columbia Freedom of Information and Privacy Association, the Center for Free Expression at Toronto Metropolitan University. I was wondering if you could speak, what was it like to speak at these associations? Did that signify anything for the path that you've paved for future student journalists?
Yeah, for sure. I think one thing that was super significant and meant a lot to me and Spencer was this one of the many you mentioned, but speaking at the British Columbia Civil Liberties Association, because that was the organization that initially helped us publish when we were faced with censorship and before we even had the idea for the campaign. It really was kind of like a full circle moment, and I know that meant a lot to both me and Spencer, but also says a lot about the conversation that's being started about press freedom for students.
Perfect, thanks. And then I have a question specific to Spencer. I was just wondering what led you to decline Harvard and stay in Canada to work on the SPFA?
Oh, we've got a lot of work to do here. One of us always has to be in BC, and we've got a law that is really novel. It's really esoteric. It's never going to be at the top of the agenda. I would love for it to be. And I'm sure Jessica would too. And we would love if it had the same following as healthcare and forestry, and all of these other portfolios. But it's going to be something that we constantly have to push for. And that is really only something that can be done in Canada. And that's why I chose to stay. And plus, UBC rocks.
I agree. Yeah, could you tell us more about the process of crafting the SPFA? Not sure who wants to take the question. Maybe a little bit of you.
Go ahead, Jessica.
Okay, yeah, for sure. So our initial idea, which doesn't really make a lot of sense looking back on it, but Spencer and I were like, we were very frustrated, obviously, with the censorship, and we said to ourselves that we were just going to write a letter to Attorney General EB. And looking back on it, I'm not sure what we thought the solution would be that would arise out of that, but that was kind of our initial idea. And then it kind of took shape after that. Spencer, do you want to elaborate?
Yeah, sure. Our initial idea was to simply just, put something on a page and send it to the Attorney General, which turned out quite terribly. But we did actually get something functional, and we had a bunch of lawyers help us out with making something legally functional beyond the idea. And it continually built from there, and we've been revising it ever since. I mean, we made contact with the government about a year ago, but throughout that time and coordinating responses from them, we've still been amending the act, and it's mainly been going to different civil liberties groups and stakeholder groups and saying, we aren't lawyers, we aren't professionals in this realm. We just have this idea, and if you could help us out, that'd be awesome. And it's a lot of getting on Zoom calls like this and share screening a PDF and going line by line and going, does this make sense? Does this make sense? How could this be interpreted? And a lot of close reading of it's a pretty short law. It's about 5 pages, something like that. But it takes an exponential amount of time, increasingly to get something like this to function. And it's mainly the conversations about what does the text mean and how should it be interpreted and what does it do, over and over and over again recursively.
Yeah, sounds like a lot of work.
Yeah.
Yeah, are there any challenges and barriers to journalism that you think high school age students face that maybe might not apply to other journalists?
Yeah, one thing that we certainly found and is common across all student journalists, and something obviously very unique to students, is they're very, very close to the systems that they're reporting on. So maybe to give an example of something that we did in high school, we reported on, figures that were in positions of authority over us in a very close way. So principals, vice principals, and kind of having to differentiate yourself when you're acting as a reporter. But of course, it's never really possible to completely eliminate, the student teacher or student administrator dynamic. Spencer, do you want to continue on?
Yeah, sure. I mean, apart from that, another corollary issue to that is going to be that there's an assumption that student journalists are not real journalists. And there's a lot of background, you know, to that. And I think personally, I mean, we never purported to be professional journalists. We've never been to J school. We've never, you know, we haven't, you know, written, you know, dozens of bylines and other publications. We're learning, and it's a learning process. And it's a significant learning curve because it's, you know, there's not a lot of room for, you know, trial and error with what we're doing. We need to get it right and has real consequences, and what we do is important, as all journalists' work is. And I think that the intention of it doesn't really, whether a journalist is professional or student, or somewhere in between, is not really, you know, at issue when it comes to looking at their work with for the purpose that it holds. We were still trying to do stuff for our community, and, you know, work in the public interest and report the truth. And I think school officials, when they feel that they have that that power over students, which they do, and they wield it in an inappropriate way, and because students are in a subordinate position, that, you know, exacerbates the idea that they aren't really practicing real journalism, which, you know, we would obviously disagree with. And thankfully, you know, the Canadian Association of Journalists agrees. And I think they're the one, we'll credit the phrase student journalists are real journalists to them.
Yeah. And by creating the SPFA, do you think student journalists will feel more at ease shedding light onto topics that have previously been classified as like stepping over a line?
I would like to say yes. I mean, it's not a silver bullet to the problem, because self-censorship is something that we can't legislate out of existence. There will always be, if there is a, you know, a controversial motion on the table of the school board that, you know, regular media isn't reporting on, because, you know, they're, you know, school board issues aren't at the top of the list of things to report on anymore. And the student journalist is the only one that can do it. But they know that they might face something, or face criticism from their principal or from administrator for, you know, quote, drawing bad attention to the school or something like that. You know, that feeling is they're still going to have to deal with. And there's still going to have to be ways to, you know, circumnavigate that so they can actually report on what matters. You know, they can't face retribution for it, but, you know, the worry of, you know, this might happen, or the 1% is still going to be there. So the SPFA, it deals with a lot of the formal problems. And it's going to be hard to have an organized effort and systematic effort to stop a student newspaper or a yearbook or a student podcast. That there's of course going to be stuff behind the scenes that you know, could be evaded by the provisions of the act that we unfortunately can't get to. So it's not a silver bullet, but overall, I think this will dramatically increase the availability of journalism to students in public schools.
Yeah, and are you taking any steps to include more youth, like throughout the process of developing the SPFA?
Yeah, so one thing that we have found both helpful but also very important is talking to other student journalists. Everyone's experience with censorship is different. It can come in so many forms, whether it's very overt or maybe more subtle. So including other student journalists in the conversation about really what they need has been something that's really important to us, and also important in, you know, making the act as strong as it possibly could be.
Yeah, and I was just wondering, how do you hope to encourage student journalists to continue to report on, you know, unique experiences and issues when they face the chance of repercussion? Like you mentioned, the act deals with the more formal stuff. Do you have any plans to sort of help encourage that to still happen?
So post the act being you know, brought into force, which we don't have a specific date for, because it's very much at the whims of the Legislative Assembly that way. You know, a follow-up to its implementation would be, you know, how do you actually use this? You know, we might have a lot of experience in interpreting, you know, our 5-page law that we've been stewarding for 1.5 years plus. But, you know, not every student journalist that is able to do that. And quite frankly, they shouldn't really have to do that. That isn't their job. They have, you know, their job is to be journalists, not lawyers for themselves, educated off of what they can find on the internet and in their library. So what we obviously need to do, you know, some follow-up and be available to student journalists, when they need help with something in the act, and actually getting over you know, getting over some of the hesitation that very much exists and we felt as well there. And that's a lot of, you know, figuring out how we did it before we had a law like that, and what circumstances existed for us that enabled that to happen. And it's about sharing that and having those conversations that should bring about the availability to actually, you know, report on things that need to get out there.
Yeah, it's almost all the time we have today. So maybe we can just leave a little bit of time for any sort of last comments, things you want to share. Maybe we'll go Jessica and then Spencer.
Yeah, for sure. First of all, thank you so much for having me and Spencer on today. But I also just wanted to emphasize to everyone the importance of supporting student journalists in the sense that you're reading their work, you're recognizing them as real sources of news, and also, you know, trusting them with your stories if there's something going on in your community or in your life that, you know, is newsworthy.
And I think I would bring to that, to student journalists who are trying to bring stories that are newsworthy to their communities, that if a principal or an administrator tells you something, you can't publish that. We just can't, even though, you know, you've put a lot of work into it. It's right. It's correct. You know, the facts are there. And their answer is, well, we just can't, you know, life's too bad. Life's not fair. Personally, I cannot stand that answer. I have never liked hearing from my administrators, things that are amounted to, you know, voicing of, oh, well, it sucks to suck, you know, life's not fair. My response to that, and student journalists' response to why they're being censored, should always be why. If there's things that legitimately need to be limited, of course there should be a specific and articulable reason, and I think it's a fair expectation of an administrator to be able to voice it. But if it's a story that's correct and it's about bringing truth to power, and a administrator just doesn't like it because they're uncomfortable because they don't like seeing criticism of the school board, or another school official doesn't like it generally, that isn't a good reason. And I would emphasize that if you're a student journalist and you hear something that amounts to life's not fair, you would ask why.
Perfect. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having us.
And that is it for our show today, everyone. Thank you all for listening, and thank you for the Chinatown Looks organizers for speaking to us, and to Spencer and Jessica for chatting with us about the Student Press Freedom Act. See you all next week.